Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Detroit Lions Breakdown Podcast. I'm Joe Cagna. With me, as always, is Eric Schlitt from PrideOfDetroit.com. Eric, last Sunday at U.S. Bank Stadium, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Lions, everything was going pretty well. End of the third quarter, it was 24-14. Dalvin Cook had been knocked out of the game. There was a soothing light at the end of the tunnel, and it turned out it was just a freight train coming their way. Vikings scored two unanswered touchdowns in the fourth quarter. End up winning 28-24.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of injuries, a lot of maybe not a lot. There's some questionable coaching incidents. We'll probably talk a little bit about those.
Yeah, a couple down the stretch that we should talk about.
All right. Like, we need to dive right in, though, to the injury report, because there's plenty to discuss there. Number one, Tracy Walker. We all saw it placed on injured reserve. Season-ending Achilles injury. So another torn Achilles for the Lions. And I don't know if we want to wait till we dig into the Minnesota game, but him being out and that KJ Osborne touchdown pass that put the Vikings ahead at the end of the game, maybe if Tracy Walker was in there, something different might have happened on that play. Maybe not. Maybe KJ still scores. I don't know.
I do. It was very obviously miscommunication. Aaron Glenn really didn't want to get into pointing fingers, basically said that both guys thought that they had the same read. They both thought that they had inside, and neither of them thought they had outside. And so, somebody messed up. Odds are it was probably the new guy, but you don't want to put blame on him if it wasn't. And I do think that if Tracy is there, it's a very different story at a lot of different points of the game, not just the end, but very much so the end.
All right. So with Walker going on IR, they signed Anthony Pittman. I'm guessing that fills out the 53-man roster there.
Yeah. And Pittman was promoted from the practice squad three times for the first three games. And he was completely out of elevations. They couldn't have elevated him anymore. They had to either sign him if they wanted him to play again, or he just, they would have had to release him and let him go somewhere else. So, obviously he could have stayed on the practice squad and they just never played, but they wanted him to play again, obviously, and he was out of elevation. So it was a natural move, I think, to sign him to the roster.
All right, injured list. Number one, running back DeAndre Swift, ankle, shoulder. No participation in practice Wednesday, Thursday. Normally not a shocker, as we've discussed over the weeks here. It would be surprising if he ever practiced during the week. But word is, we might not have him on Sunday.
Yeah, Dan Campbell basically described needing a miracle for him to be ready on time. I mean, he talked about lights coming down from the heavens and all of a sudden him having this miraculous recovery. And it just doesn't seem realistic. I think he was exaggerating to prove a point. And I think those, most people know at this point that it's going to be Jamal Williams as the starter.
Wide receiver, Amon-Ra St. Brown, ankle injury, did not practice Wednesday or Thursday.
This one's a little bit more optimistic. He talked to the media, which is usually a good sign. He said it's only an ankle, quote unquote, only an ankle. So, but he did admit it, he's day to day. So Friday's practice will go a long way. My guess is he ends up questionable, but I do think he's a truly questionable decision where he could be a guy who ends up being ruled out like on Saturday or something like that.
Wide receiver DJ Chark, ankle injury, limited Wednesday, did not practice on Thursday.
Yeah, this one's a little tricky because you don't know if he's just getting a rest day and they didn't want to have all their starters out on the same day, but they wanted to give Chark a rest day and they wanted to give Reynolds a rest day. And so they just kind of like staggered them. Or maybe he re-aggravated it in practice. It's really unclear. Campbell doesn't talk to the media on Thursday, so there's no real clarification. And, you have to kind of see. Indicators to me, though, if you kind of read between the lines, I believe he's going to play. When Campbell was talking about players that needed to step up because of the injuries, he was saying TJ Hawkinson, he was saying DJ Chark, and he was saying Jamal Williams. all guys. He's like, I expect Jamal to have a big game. I expect, you know, Chark to have a big game. I expect TJ to have a big game. So like, even the, even if though he's injured, they're talking about him like he, they're expecting him to play.
Wide receiver Josh Reynolds, ankle injury, did not practice Wednesday, limited Thursday.
Yeah, and so a little bit of like the reverse of DJ, essentially. They've said all week that he's ahead of Amon-Ra in his recovery, and that came true here where he was able to get a limited practice in before Amon-Ra. And so, yeah, I think they're counting on him being there as well, which means – you're probably, and again, I'm speculating, but you're probably going to have your two outside starters. You may have to replace Amon-Ra, but it's, you know, the way that that kid works and the fact that he's so young, who knows, he could bounce back and be ready to go. It's that's a bit of an unknown.
Tight end TJ Hockenson, foot injury, did not practice Wednesday, limited Thursday. Kind of touched on him already.
It's worth noting he had a hip injury last week. Now it's a foot injury. So it's, but again, I think he's on that rest early in the week program that they like to do. Limited is a good indicator. Plus what I said earlier about Dan Campbell saying that he thought he might have a big day.
Center Frank Ragnow, foot injury, did not practice Wednesday, limited Thursday.
He's going to play. I mean, they're talking about him being back as if it's an automatic thing. And so I don't think that's going to be an issue. You're going to have Decker. You're going to have Frank. You're going to have Sewell. And then if interior plays out as it did last week, it's probably going to be Evan Brown at right guard. And if Jonah can't go, then it's going to be probably Dan Skipper one more time.
All right. So spoiler alert, the next one on the list was guard Jonah Jackson, finger injury, did not practice Wednesday, Thursday.
So he basically said like his left hand is his power hand. It's the one that he uses for all his initial moves, and being on the left side, that makes sense, right? You hit with your outside hand. And that's where his injury is. And he said right now he can't even bend it. And if he can't bend it, then there's a lot of stuff you can't do. And he said he bumped it the other day and the pain was excruciating. And so like, you're not blocking 300 pound linemen with, if you're bumping it on a table and you're, you know, feeling that much pain. It's, I think even though he says he wants to be back and he's hoping to be back before the bye, I would be surprised if they pushed him to that point. So I'm expecting him to be out again.
That was 7/11 of the starting offense, just to note.
Yeah.
Next up, defensive lineman John Kaminsky, no surprise here, wrist injury, did not practice Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah, he's just over a week from surgery where he had like a cast on his wrist. I would be shocked if he somehow showed up in a club and then ended up playing.
Linebacker Chris Board, knee injury, did not practice Wednesday, limited Thursday.
Sounds like he's on the right track to recover. It doesn't sound like they're too worried about him.
Cornerback Bobby Price, shin injury, did not practice Wednesday, limited Thursday.
Same type of deal. Taking it easy on him early in the week, letting him rest up.
Kicker Austin Seibert, right groin injury, did not practice Wednesday, Thursday. No Riley Patterson to turn to.
Mm-hmm. Again, when you talk to Phipp, or when you listen to Phipp, he talks about Seibert being, you know, like it being really nothing and him not really stressing about it too much. It's a groin injury on his kicking leg. And so groin injuries, you just need to rest. So it wouldn't surprise me if he was missed practice Friday and was still listed as questionable and then, you know, maybe played on Sunday. If for some reason he's not, Dominic Eberle is the practice squad kicker. They would call him up.
All right, let's talk about the Vikings game first. We're going to talk about all these fourth down decisions. Now, the first fourth down decision kind of sets up the rest of the fourth down decisions. It kind of feels like it. Their first fourth down, that was the opening possession, if I'm not mistaken, right? Lions drive down to the Viking 30-yard line, fourth and six. They attempt a 48-yard field goal by Seibert, which, even though it was against us, I love how they have that microphone right on the goalposts. Mm-hmm. When that thing just plowed off the right goalpost. And all right, well, 0-0. Here we go.
All right.
But Lions converted a bunch. Then they do a couple of weird things late when they're having these fourth. Like, you know, what are your thoughts on this, Eric?
I enjoy the aggressiveness of going for it when you're at midfield, or going for it when you're just slightly into the opponent's territory. Or if you feel like you're moving the ball, but you're just happening into a bad spot. With this rushing attack, if they just kind of play it straightforward, a lot of times they're going to get those fourth down calls. And so I thought the aggressiveness was a positive. I didn't like the fourth down call at the end of the half where they, where they didn't convert. But at the same time, I'm okay with the call. I'm okay with going for it. I mean, not necessarily the play, but I like the idea of just saying, okay, we think we're going to get it. We had already converted like however many. And so I thought that was a fine decision by me, by my standards. And then at the end of the game, when you've been aggressive all game and you get into that situation where it's a long field goal, and that field goal is only going to put you up six. And if you miss it, you're giving them the ball in plus territory. If you make it, it doesn't really benefit you a whole bunch. Now they have to score instead of kick a field goal, but there was plenty enough time for them to do that. I wouldn't even have hated a pooch punt, like, you know, to have Jack Fox.
I was going to say, because it's something that nobody's really been talking about is, yeah, would you have punted in that situation? Would that be a consideration?
I thought about like what I would have done, right? Because like the week prior, they needed to get it and they got it on fourth down. Right. And so I'm looking at that situation and I'm saying, man, if they convert, it's basically the game's basically going to be close to over. Right. And so you're going to put them in a real hard spot. So again, I would have gone for it. And the, as aggressive as he was earlier in the game, he backed his foot off the gas there quite a bit and decided to kick it. And, I didn't like that call. It went against everything that that was working right for them. They had, you know, failed on a couple of conversions. And so maybe they were a little bit gun shy. They trust Seibert to hit from distance, which he's really been a bit inconsistent when you get in that 48 to beyond range. And so I didn't see the benefit. I didn't see the benefit of going for a field goal. It seemed like it was a much, much more to lose by missing than you would have gained by converting. And so I didn't like the call. I obviously the results were the worst case scenario in my opinion. And I would have liked to have seen them just try and put hat on hat and just make something happen. But that's not what happened. He got passive, which is a bit shocking.
So you're all right with the fourth, when they went for it on fourth and one, instead of kicking the 48 yard field goal, the yes, second from last possession. It was a yep, poor play call. They send Williams to the right, just run the ball. And I get why they did it too, because you had the pass to St. Brown on fourth down. You had the pass to Reynolds on fourth down. The Vikings were probably kind of expecting maybe one of those pass plays. But mm-hmm, it's like, well, this is what we're going to try to plow it up the middle or off to the right on fourth and one.
Yeah, I would have gone right.
It's, you know, it's interesting. Well, the last call is like, you've lost. He was right up to that point. Like, he's totally lost confidence in Cyber. And maybe it's not even lose confidence. It's that both kickers on that end were missing to the right.
Yeah.
You know, real poorly to the right. So why would you think all of a sudden, oh, he's going to go out here, nail this 54-yarder after passing up a 48-yarder, you know, the possession before, and him missing the 48-yarder at the beginning of the game, and then seeing, what's his name, Joseph. Who's the Minnesota kicker?
Oh, what's his name?
Whatever. He goes out there and he misses that same field goal. I don't know why he let that creep into his mind to kick the field goal. Like, people would have hated it if he punted, because I would have bet if they punted, the ending still might have been the same.
Sure.
Fox isn't a great coffin corner kicker. He's got a huge leg on him.
And
but
he
doesn't pin him deep, you know, when he's in close like that. Go ahead, Eric.
He also was a bit inconsistent on the day as well. And that's not something you see out of him that often. And so when you have an inconsistent punter on the day, and then you have a field goal kicker who's already missed from distance, And now you're putting him in an even tougher situation. There was just too many things that I thought could have gone wrong. And they did. When you miss that, it also puts the defense on their heels, right? And you've got a defense that had been giving up yardage. You've got a safety in there that doesn't, hasn't been working with everyone a whole lot. And it was very against character for me. That fourth down that they tried to Josh Reynolds, where they threw it like for fourth and one, they threw like for him, like 15 yards on the field or whatever. I didn't like that call. They said that they had been setting that one up essentially. Like they saw something in the defense that they thought they could take advantage of. I don't see the point in trying to hit a 17 yard pass when you only need a yard. You know what I mean? Like you can run that same concept that's not 17 yards down the field against, you know what I mean? If you can get it at 17, if you think you can get it at 17, you can probably get it at 7. And I would go for the higher percentage throw, but you know, whatever. I didn't like that one either, but I get it.
All right. So we can Monday morning quarterback this. Sure. Program. It's not going to get us anywhere. I'm going to ask you, I think I already know what your answer is, because I think you're all for Dan Campbell being the uber aggressive guy. And I don't mind the aggressiveness either, but what we've seen out of the Lions these first 3 weeks, they've jumped an echelon in the league. Last year, they were terrible. There was a terrible football team. This year, they've shown they can win any game. I'm not saying that they're going to go 14-3, but they can show up in any game and win. They're now one of those NFL teams. There's probably 24 of them that could go out there every week and win every game. They're not good enough to, you know, win 14 out of 17, but they're good enough to be in every game, you know, like, and potentially win every one of them. They got to catch certain teams on a bad day, but if they play a good game, they're going to win. That wasn't true all the time last year, but I think it's true now. Does Campbell now, he's aggressive, but does he start playing it a little bit different because he's got a team that's good enough to win?
I think he's being
aggressive all the time when you're bad, because why not? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. We talked about that a lot. We talked about that a lot last year, right? Like it almost was a benefit to be aggressive when you didn't have the skill players. I'm still in the mindset of it's still important to be aggressive. Now, I don't know if you need to go for it on fourth down six times. You know what I mean? Like that might be
all
a little
of them
bit
are
excessive.
Defensible though.
They are.
Every
and
one
that's,
of them
that,
that yeah, they're defensible going for it on fourth
and,
down.
And that's the thing. And so I don't think you need to be that team that goes for it six times.
Right. That's what I would say. Like,
but if the situation calls for it, I'm okay with erring on the side of aggressiveness. You know, your defense is giving up a lot of points, right? You're most in the league right now. And so even if your offense is good, I'm okay trying to keep them on the field. What I didn't like, in addition to those two calls, what I didn't like was the way that they shifted away from the run into a more pass focused offense. I did not like that. Now maybe some of that was Swift wasn't 100% and they were trying to mitigate his injury. But at the same time, they put Evan Brown in at right guard and took out Logan Stenberg. Now Brown is a much better pass pro guy, and he's an average run blocker.
Struggle a little more running the ball.
Yes. Yeah, if they did. And I think that decision showed that they were trying to be a little bit more pass friendly. And that approach to me, essentially what they were doing was they were trying to pass to set up the run, which is the opposite of what they did the first 2 weeks where they were running to set up the pass. And I didn't like that approach. You could kind of feel it like you. And again, I don't know if Swift's injury was kind of the catalyst and kind of pivoting towards that. But for whatever reason, it sure seemed like they were shifting towards wanting to put the ball in Goff's hand against Minnesota. And I didn't think you should do that. I mean, we talked about it last week on the podcast. I thought they could run on this team and they just needed to continue to try and assert themselves. I was not as terrified of the interior pass rush. I thought Stenberg might have been the better choice if you're looking to be power.
But they
wanted to shift away. And I didn't like that decision. That decision rubbed me wrong. But honestly, at this point, with no Swift, they're probably going to have to stay pass focused for the next two games as well. Like I think they've kind of put themselves in this position. Now, I would like them to go back to run, but if they're going to stick with Evan Brown, which it sure seems like they're going to, and you don't have Swift for the next couple of games, I think they're going to try and stick with the style of offense that we saw against Minnesota, which is counter to what I think they should be doing, especially this week against Seattle.
See, that was interesting, because you're right about the point is they can't go back on it now. Evan Brown's the starting right guard. As long as the offensive line is the way it is, he's going to continue being the starting right guard. Whereas you'd think with Swift's injury, let's get Stenberg back out there and give Williams a little more help and still try to generate the run game and do what you can with Craig Reynolds playing the Swift role. But, you know.
Look, it is Evan Brown is a better offensive lineman.
Sure.
I don't think anyone is going to argue the opposite. But Stenberg lets you run the way you want to run. And maybe Evan Brown shows me something more, but Evan Brown he lacks that anchor, that strength to be able to move people the way that Logan does. And even though I think he's not as good overall, he's better in the area that I want him to be. And I would like to see Evan back in or Logan back in, but I think it's going to be Evan the whole way. I think they trust him more and they want to keep Goff upright more. And so my opinion, they're going to try and run left or outside of Sewell. And they're going to just count on the pass pro from Evan to keep them upright.
Now, when people say that you're a homer, Eric, you can point to this moment where this is a team that ran for 139 yards on Sunday, and you're upset about it. It's not enough. Right?
I know. I feel like I'm being overly critical because Jamal runs for 80 yards and two touchdowns. Two touchdowns.
But you're not being overly. I think you're right.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of it too. I'd like them to go back because Seattle's run defense, and we'll get into that in a minute, is vulnerable. And I think Jamal, he doesn't have as much explosiveness as Swift, but even without that, I still think Jamal can make some noise against Seattle's run defense. If you don't move away from the run, if you try and lean on it like you did in the first two games.
All right, adjusting to injuries. This team's ability to adjust to injuries is going to be very important.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about
Sunday.
Yeah,
and
we're talking about,
and then what happened in the game with Walker getting hurt and being out for the year.
Yeah, I mean, and everything shifted, right? Like when Amon-Ra went down, they tried to put more balls on the outside, which in that umbrella that we talked about that the Vikings run, like you don't always have those outside lanes. And so they were forcing it outside a ton. I mean, they were pushing that ball outside to the sidelines a lot. And that was like, it's almost like favoring, giving an advantage to the Vikings corners because they're kind of playing out on that boundary. And so I would have liked to have seen them go over the middle more. That's where I thought they would have been vulnerable. And so it was a couple of things on offense that I wish they would have changed. And I think some of it was dictated by the fact that Swift and Amon-Ra were both hurt. Then on defense, they didn't adjust anything, but the Juju Hughes, even though I thought Juju played well, that was a very costly mistake at the end, which I am, I'm again assuming that it was, he was at least 50% at fault on that, right? And I thought Mike Hughes started that game out on fire playing really well, and then his play just declined. And now it's left me wondering if they have a different answer at nickel that they might be looking at. And then, of course, Amani.
Where's Chase Lucas.
Yeah, right, maybe. And then I think Amani's back injury showed up as well.
Poor Amani.
Yeah, when you have a back injury and you can't bend, you grab. And once you grab once and then you grab twice, then they start looking for it, and then they start calling
five times
or six. Yeah, just a bunch. So these injuries, have all kind of played. The in-game injuries, I think, played a role in how they had to adjust. And just I think that, again, that Swift injury, I think, dictated how they wanted to approach the offense. This week, again, with no Swift, no Amon-Ra, you're going to kind of see a lot of the same type of concepts, I believe. Now, my hope is that you lean on Hockenson a little bit more. And then we'll get into why the Seattle defense is more vulnerable because they run a different scheme than the Vikings do, and why that approach that they took last week should work against Seattle this week.
All right, so let's stop dwelling on the past and let's talk about the future. The Seattle Seahawks coming to town to Ford Field Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock. It's a Fox game with Chris Myers, Robert Smith, and Jen Hale. Runs a little bit counter to what you were saying the other day, who might be in the booth. You were corrected, though.
I tell you, the NFL Communications puts out a press release with a whole bunch of stats and facts and stuff like that on every single game. And I use that as a reference to, see things that I might have missed, different statistical anomalies, just try and familiarize myself with what's going on. Just a little one-page recap on each game. And in there, they had listed that Matt Millen was going to be the color commentator. And so I was shocked when I ran across it. I was like, all right, well, I put it out there on social media to see.
And to infuriate everybody, gaslight everyone.
And then Megan Alevi, who is the field judge, or the field judge, field reporter. She actually, I don't know if someone tagged her or what, but she responded to me and she was like, no, actually that crew that you listed is for the following week in New Orleans or something like that. And so she was the one that identified that, hey, NFL Communications got it wrong. And so then it didn't take too long to find the team right up. And then they had the right one with Chris Myers. And then a couple other sources had it as that as well. So
506sports.com.
506 Sports absolutely had it that way. The Lions had it that way. And then there was another one that had it that way as well. And so I was like, all right.
In the end, Eric, who cares? I'm sure somebody liked making fun of you for it, but what's the big deal?
Well, I trusted the NFL. That was my mistake.
That's what you get. That was look how many guys did that for decades when it came to their brains. Anyhow, betting line: Lions were favored by 7 at the get go. Six at the get go. Jumped up to 6.5. Then everybody got hurt during the week, or everybody started not reporting to practice. Dropped down to Lions by 4. It is now, I just checked, bumped up to 4.5. So Lions favored by 4.5. Is this two? No, it's not two. They weren't favored against Vikings. Never mind. 2 out of 4 games, though, favored. Correct. This season.
Yep.
So that's something. No.
Well, these were the two games that they were favored. 2 of the 4 games they were favored in when the schedule originally came out as well. So it's not overly surprising that really they're favored. They were favored by 1 initially. I was surprised when they were favored by 6. The last time that they were favored by 6, I don't know if we want to go down this road, but the last time that they were favored by 6 or more points was a Monday Night Football game in 2008 against the New York Jets when Matt Patricia made his.
It wasn't 2018, week one 18, of 2018. 18,
sorry, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
It's like, was that long ago? No. Yeah. I remember that game. I think everybody does.
Yeah. That was an ugly game. So I'm glad that the line is not 6 anymore, so that we don't have to wash that off of us. And it's down to 4. I think that's a more reasonable number.
All right, referees, Clay Martin.
I don't have a lot to say on him. I don't have anything unique or out of the ordinary.
All right, so talking about offseason moves for the Seahawks. Number 1, traded away Russell Wilson. Everybody knows that. Got Drew Lock and a bunch of other stuff in return. Noah Fant, the tight end. Edge rusher Shelby Harris. And I think they got some draft picks too. Lock's not the quarterback. We'll talk about Geno Smith in a minute. Go ahead, Eric.
I was going to say, I got 2 firsts and 2 seconds in that trade as well. But one of the first and seconds are already gone on their draft class. And then they'll have one more, a first and a second in this upcoming, and then that trade will be completed.
Uchenna Nwosu, also in, edge rusher. Edge rusher Carlos Dunlap, edge rusher Kerry Hyder, former Lion, but he's already gone.
Yeah, so they basically swapped out Dunlap and Hyder for Harris and Nwosu, right? Nwosu was a backup with the Rams, and he is a starter on this defense, and he's actually playing pretty well. So could just be opportunity, or maybe he's just having it's a better system, whatever the case may be. But in my opinion, it's a bit of a downgrade because Hyder and Dunlap, I think, were pretty good edge guys. And it really comes down to the fact that they were switching schemes, and we'll talk about that in a bit.
Lost linebacker Bobby Wagner. Everybody knows that, to the Rams. All right. The draft, offensive tackle in the first round, Charles Cross. He's starting at left tackle. Round two, edge rusher Boye Mafe. Also in round two, running back Kenneth Walker III for Michigan State. You know, he had his hernia surgery. He hasn't been playing much so far. Round three, offensive tackle Abraham Lucas. He's starting over on the right side. Round four, cornerback Kobe Bryant from Cincinnati. He's the starting nickelback. And round five's cornerback Tariq Woolen. He's one of the other starting corners. So they've got a lot of starters out of this draft class, but it's also an indication that this is a rebuilding phase for the Seahawks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll get to the offensive line in detail, but having two rookies on the edges is not ideal, even though they're not playing bad. So they're leaning on those guys. Walker is kind of like, in my opinion, he looks like the better back, but Penny is that workhorse that they want to lean on. And so they defer to him. I think eventually Walker's going to be the guy, right?
The
yep. Yeah. Right now he's kind of like, they're using him kind of like a third down back. They're getting him into space. They're using him on, you know, gadget plays, like end rounds and stuff like that. And then they're throwing him the ball as well. It's not as much a traditional running back type of set with him, like they do with, they typically defer to Penny on that. And then the secondary, you got a couple of starters, and that's really because they've either had an injury or because the other guys just haven't been playing well. Woolen is really raw. He's a really raw player. Athletic is all can be, but he's a fifth rounder for a reason. And you're going to ask him to try and cover a Josh Reynolds or a DJ Chark. And it's going to be a tall order against one of those, because they're both kind of savvy route runners. So be a couple advantages for the Lions on defense.
All right. The record's 1-2. They beat the Broncos in that revenge game against Russell Wilson, 17-16. That was opening Sunday night, right? Sunday or Monday night. I can't remember. It was a night game. Yeah. Lost to the 49ers 27-7, then lost to the Falcons 27-23. So they're capable of scoring points, but the other team's defense has got to be bad. Lucky for them. Jamal Adams, he's out. He's a key injury for the Seahawks.
Yeah, season-ending quad injury. So he's not even like going to be coming back. Like, he's just done. And that's forced them to, you know, shift their secondary, or, you know, shift to a couple guys in the secondary around as well. So secondary's got some movement.
All right, and then you've got a couple of stats to know, Eric. Why don't you tell us about them?
So on offense, over the three games that they've played, they've only scored 10 second half points. So
the Lions
all three games.
Well.
Yep. Right. So basically they're just not a second half team. They have not adjusted well so far. And when the other teams have, they haven't been able to adjust in game either. And so it's a team that has a pretty decent offense, but they just can't click it together in the second half for whatever reason. And so they've struggled. So that's one of the key stats on offense. The defensive one, though, I thought was a bit surprising. They did not allow, or they did not force a team to go three and out. until there were 3 minutes left in the third game, in the second quarter of the third game. So like the whole first two games, they didn't force a three and out at all. Like that kind of tells you like the level of where this defense is right now. And so to me, that's a startling number. They've only forced one three and out on the season, and it came, you know, in the third game of the year. So Lions, you know, we've criticized them for going three and out. Yeah.
Only one three and out on Sunday. Yeah,
and so again, I think this is one of those situations where it could be potentially a big advantage for the Lions. If they aren't going three and out, they can sustain drives. If they can sustain drives and they put up, then they've shown that they can put up points. And so I like that as a stat that really heavily favors the Lions, allow them to do what they want to do on offense.
All right. So we see the Lions advantage. We think it's going to be on offense. So we'll start on the offense. We'll talk about the Seattle base 3-4 defense, right? Starting along their defensive line, we talked a little bit about Shelby Harris. He's one end, Puna Ford on the other side with Al Woods in the middle.
And then Quentin Jefferson actually will start or will like rotate with Harris as well. And because Harris has been hurt, he's dealing with a glute injury right now. Did not practice earlier in the week. And so if Harris isn't going, then they're leaning on Jefferson. And they haven't really been good against the run, right? I'll give you a couple more stats that jumped out to me as far as run defense. So Shelby Harris is actually their best run defender on the defensive line. He has a PFF run defensive grade of 60.3. 60 is average. Mm-hmm. His is 60.3. So he's basically an average run defender. He's the best one they have in their front. Jefferson, who is starting in his place, has a run defensive grade of 34.6. Woods, their nose tackle, his is 57.5, and Ford is 45.4. So they're all really under average across the board. And even when you get into the reserves, they're underwhelming as well. So that run, that defensive front is really vulnerable to the run. If you watch the Falcons games, Cordell Patterson set records for rushing over his career. The Falcons offensive line was like just out leveraging them and gaining angles. And it was really easy for them to take advantage of what they wanted to do with the Falcons rushing attack.
Yeah. Falcons rushing attack, 179 yards rushing on only 31 carries. So over 5 yards a carry. So how do they line up? You know, is Al Woods, is he, you know, he's not head up on Bragg now. He's going to be shading to one side or the other, the weak side.
Yeah, essentially what they run,
what we saw with the Patricia era defense.
Exactly. Exactly right. It's a 3-4 in its base concept, but what they're basically running is a shaded 4-man front, which uses like a jack linebacker. And then they actually run with like 3 stack linebackers behind. So it looks like a 4-3, but from a personnel standpoint, it's technically a 3-4. They will shift the front to a pure 3-4, depending on what they're trying to accomplish. I've noticed that when they do a lot of 2 deep safeties, they'll use a base normal 3-4 front. But when they go to like a single high, which they do a ton, they run with like 4 across the line and then a linebacker stack behind them. Essentially what they're doing is they're running this, like this 3-4 base, but they run like, most of the time, like I said, a single high safety who basically just sits back into that shell. And then the linebackers just stay about 5 yards behind the defensive line. They don't run downhill to stop the run, which is why teams gash them. They don't drop back into coverage to shorten the zones. So they just kind of like hover in that medium range. And for a lot of quarterbacks, that makes sense because you know, most quarterbacks are successful in that, you know, 0 to 10 yard range. So that's where they're kind of stacking those linebackers in that five, and then trying to take that part of the field away. But what ends up happening is if your corners are trying to maintain outside leverage, you have the deep middle of the field, like the 10 yards, the 15 yards part of the field that's open that you can attack, so that you can run those in breaking routes, and those should be open. You also, if you don't maintain outside control, which they don't always do because they have young corners on the outside, then you can get deep, and then it's one-on-one and the safety can't make it over. And then you just have to beat your guy down the sideline. And if you have a fast receiver like a DJ Chark, then that's an opportunity for you. So their defensive scheme, it doesn't really excel in every area. It's almost like a bend don't break, right? Where they're trying to just kind of put guys in the way without actually being aggressive and committing to anything. And honestly, it's part of the reason why they're getting gashed the way they are.
Linebacking crew: Daryl Taylor, Jordan Brooks, Cody Barton, Uchenna Nwosu.
Nwosu, I think, is playing the best of that group. I think the rest of the group is kind of underwhelming, to be honest. And they have not been playing well. The whole front seven has really had a hard go of it this year.
Nick Ballore backing up the middle, the inside backers.
Yeah. He doesn't really play linebacker a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Who's Penei Sewell going to be mauling on Sunday? He's going to take his turn on everybody.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think how they do it. It depends on really what front they're going to do. Like if they're going to run their shaded, like hybrid 3-4 front with four guys, then it's going to be Ford. They're going to get like Puna Ford against him. All and right. he should be able to bounce him around. When he's not, it could be Taylor. It could be Nwosu.
So it just depends. Doing some chasing.
Yeah, look, and they pull him all over the place, right? Like part of the success that they've had is that they're using him on like pulls, they're shifting him around, and like so he's going to end up like getting one-on-one with Nwosu at some point probably as well. So even though Nwosu's on the other side of the field a lot of the time, so it just depends, you know, exactly what front that they're in. But I don't think there is a player on this defense that is really going to be able to make any noise against Penei.
All right.
Who is the PFF's number one right tackle right now?
I was waiting for you to bust that out on us. I remember you telling me earlier in the week. It's like, well, he's got to mention it, these special stats. All right. The back four for Seattle: Mike Jackson and Tariq Woolen. We mentioned Tariq. They're the corners with Josh Jones and Quandre Diggs as the safeties. Yeah. Diggs would be that single high, right?
Yeah. Most of the time, Diggs is that single high, and that's a tough ask for him. They play him like really deep, and it doesn't, like, he's basically chasing like all the time, just chasing. And Josh Jones, for those of you who don't remember, he was with the Green Bay for a while, if I'm not mistaken. I believe that's the same Josh Jones, and he was a guy that like had a hard time catching on. And so he's really a replacement level player. And so that's a vulnerable spot. Like there was a couple of times when they were running a cover two and they ran Atlanta ran just one of their receivers right at the safety. The corner played to his outside leverage and the safety just froze. Like Jones just stood there. He didn't fall back to try and keep over the top. He didn't turn and run with them. He didn't pinch up on the guy who was running the crossing route underneath. He just kind of stood there, and Mariota had his pick of wherever he wanted to go with the ball, really. And so I was not overly impressed with how Josh Jones played in that game.
Josh Jones was with the Green Bay Packers 2017, 2018, his first two seasons, bounced around since Dallas, Jacksonville, Indianapolis, and now with Seattle. Two career interceptions, 61 career games. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say he didn't play well in the game in the last game that I watched for sure.
Who from the Lions works for the Seahawks? What coach or front office? They've got Justin Coleman. They've got Quandre Diggs. They've got Tease Tabor. They have Nick Ballor. Like, who on the defense has their...
I think they have Christian Jones, too, right? As well, at linebacker, if I'm not mistaken. And, right? Isn't Christian Jones on there at linebacker?
I don't see him on the depth chart.
I thought he was. I might be mistaken.
A lot of ex-Lions, though, peppered throughout that secondary. Yeah. The Diggs one, though, that was them, you know, screwing over Bob Quinn and Matt, you know, like, or taking advantage of Bob Quinn and Matt Patricia since they were angry at him, you know, like.
Certainly.
So that was a swindling more than anything else. But these other guys, are they all on the run? Tease Tabor still in the league.
Justin Coleman started his career in New England, then he went to Seattle, and then he went to Detroit, right. And now he's now he's back. So that's my guess is why he's back there. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a bunch of young guys. You know, I like Kobe Bryant a lot. I think he's a good player. I also think it's a tough spot for him as a rookie.
He's a rookie, young guy.
Yeah. I don't know if he's going to be able to hang with like a Khalif Raymond or a St. Brown or whoever's in the slot. It's going to be a tough thing. Woolen is this big athletic freak, but I think he can get manipulated by the routes that of the veteran receivers that they have. Quandre is their best player on defense, and it's not close, but they put him in single high and they don't really match him up on anybody. And so there's just advantage after advantage with the Lions. And this is a defense that is giving up points, is giving up opportunities for teams to score touchdowns. They haven't given up a ton, right? Like they've only given up 16, 27, 27, right? But at the same time, the Lions are the second highest scoring offense in the league, right? So I think the Lions are more suited to go above what we've seen
projections are. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Flipping over to the offensive side of the ball for the Seahawks. Quarterbacks, Geno Smith. Geno's been hanging around, finally got a shot as the starter. He's not great.
He's not terrible either.
Right. He's serviceable.
He's been more accurate this year than I can remember him being in the past. They do like to keep him throwing within the 10-yard range, right? When he throws it within the 10-yard range, let me look at my notes real fast here. Last week when he threw under 10 yards, he was 25 of 28. When he threw past 10 yards, he was 9 of 16. But if he went past 15, he was 6 of 12, right? So, but at the same time, his two touchdown passes were both over 15 yards as well. So while he was only 50% when throwing downfield, that's when he managed to put points on the board. And you saw that in game one as well. His touchdown pass was a longer pass down the field. But the majority of the time he is scoring, he is completing passes in that kind of short range where he is, taking what's there as opposed to trying to like really be aggressive. Yeah, he's got a little bit of mobility, which is of course helps him, but he's not like a Hurts like you saw in week one.
Not only is his completion percentage good, Eric, it's 77.5 on the season.
Yeah, yeah.
It's outrageous. Although it's less than 10 yards per completion, but he's hitting on him.
Mm-hmm.
He's been accurate.
And he's not even really targeting his receivers as much as you would think. A lot of his success has come targeting like running backs and tight ends. Like for example, for the running backs, he completed six passes for 34 yards to running backs last week. He had nine passes completed to tight ends for close to 100. He did not throw an incompletion against or to any tight end or to any running back, and he threw to three different running backs and three different tight ends. So he's a guy who is pretty accurate with when he hits his target.
All right, on to the running backs. We talked a little bit about Rashad Penny, Kenneth Walker III. They use DJ Dallas. We'll see all three of these guys, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. all the passes he's completing to backs. I think Walker had three receptions. Dallas, I think, had three receptions. Like, that's who the passes are going to. Mm-hmm. Dallas had 2 for 17, Walker 3 for 14. I know that's not their strong. That's not a bad running back core.
No, and they like to lean on Penny. And Walker's a good runner. The problem with them...
Understatement.
the problem with them is the offensive line just isn't really getting push. They're very, like, kind of helter-skelter on their effectiveness. At times, they will block a run play perfectly, and Penny will gash a team for 8 yards. And then on the very next play... they're allowing like four people to rush into the backfield for a tackle for loss. Like, it's just very hit and miss. And I think the interior offensive line is, even though you have rookies on the outside, the interior has really been a weakness. And that's really what stunted the running game for them. It's not the backs. The backs are pretty good. It's the offensive line.
Wide receiver core, this is their strongest position group on offense. Mm-hmm. Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, everybody listening is probably well acquainted with these guys. They've had them on fantasy teams. Marquise Goodwin, third receiver, but he's listed as questionable. Is he even going to play on Sunday?
It's kind of up in the air. We'll see where that goes. Lockett, what they did last game with Lockett was they basically just used him as like their kind of intermittent type of receiver. They throw a lot of like less than 15 yard passes to him. They complete a lot of passes to him, but he doesn't gain a whole lot of yards because defenses typically just kind of keep him in front. And then because he's a dangerous weapon, right? So they keep him in front and then they let him make the catch and then they just tackle him. So basically what you end up getting is 9 catches on 11 targets, for, just 76 yards, right? So it's not a great average per catch for Lockett. And then when they want to go downfield, they go to Metcalf or Marquise Goodwin. And that's where you start finding the inconsistencies where he's not hitting them. Metcalf was only 5 of 12 last week. Goodwin was only caught 2 of his 5 balls. So that's where you start to see the inaccuracies of Geno start to pop up a little bit, and the receivers aren't able to adjust. And honestly, they've dropped a few, I think, as well. But Lockett is the guy I think is the best receiver of the group, even though Metcalf gets all the glory because he's this big,
it's more explosive. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And he's a massive player. Yeah,
he's a specimen.
Yeah, and I think they're gonna just drop a coup on him and then we'll see what happens.
You know, the back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Well,
there's a lot going on between those two anyways, because Metcalf was asked, they mentioned how Akuda's is a lockdown corner. He's like, you're not a lockdown corner if there is a safety up above you. And
yeah, and, more or less. He did quantify it and say he is a good corner, but he did say, yeah, he's getting safety help, so he's not really locking people down. The thing is did he get safety help? Absolutely. That was part of the game plan with Justin Jefferson, who's an elite receiver. At the same time, he wasn't always getting safety help over the top, and he wasn't getting safety help over the top in the games prior. And so he's still managing to play awfully well. And the way that they're asking him to play, it's a lot of man on man with a shadow. When he has a shadow over the top, it's just that safety in his zone. So like, he's still having to play man on man, and it's hard to argue against the results from the receivers he's playing. So, You know, I don't think Metcalf was trying to start anything. I'm sure it made its way to the locker room, and I'm sure Jeff Okuda took offense. And
yeah, he should. He doesn't have to listen to the part where he said he was a good corner. Yeah, let's listen to the other part.
And he's out to prove people wrong. In my opinion, again, Metcalf is this big specimen of a guy. You don't have to put a safety over the top of Metcalf. In my opinion, I would let Jeff take Metcalf. I would put Amani on Lockett, which is an advantage to Lockett. And then I would roll the safety that way if I'm going to roll a safety. And because Jeff isn't going to have to always have perfect coverage against Metcalf, because Metcalf is a good receiver and he'll get open. But Geno's not always putting the ball on him 100% either. You know what I mean? So if Metcalf's only getting the ball 50% of the throws that come his way, I'll take that. You know, I'll just put Jeff on him and let Jeff kind of, you know, see what he can do with them.
Tight end group. This is pretty solid pass catching group of tight ends. Noah Fant, Will Dissly, Colby Parkinson, who had 44 yards receiving on two catches on Sunday.
Yeah, this is Geno's security blanket. This is where he likes to go when he needs something, or when he feels, you know, like he needs to, you know, get a rhythm going, or he needs to get a completion for a first down. These are the guys that he typically targets. And what we saw from Atlanta last week was when Atlanta started to take the tight end out of the equation, Geno didn't have the answer for it. And I think, you know, you've seen that happen in the previous games as well, which is why they've struggled in the second half. When teams adjust to the tight end group, Geno hasn't been able to, adjust out of it.
I will mention the next guy because of what happened last week. Fullback, who also is a backup linebacker, Nick Mallor. After last week, I said CJ Hams, the Vikings fullback. Yeah, they don't use him. What does he do? He had 15 yards on two carries. I think he caught a couple of passes too. He went out there. They get two receptions, 15 yards. They used him.
No, he's better than Ballor too. So,
yeah. Full disclosure, Ballor didn't touch the ball on Sunday.
Yeah, look, this group on offense, they can possess the ball. They can move it down the field. They can score. But once they kind of get figured out, they don't adjust well. And so that's really what you're kind of hoping for if you're Aaron Glenn. You kind of weather the storm, make your adjustments, and then just outlast them. Because it's the offense is much further along than the defense. The defense is a problem for them. And so it might look like a shootout in the first half, and then, you know, you could see the Lions maybe pull away, or maybe, you know, they keep it in because the Lions defense is working through injuries or not adjusting properly or whatever reason, right? Like last game, they had the answers on how to beat Minnesota, but they couldn't do it, right? You know, right. Maybe if they have the answers this week, they still have to do it though. That's going to be, you know, they need to show that they can do it where last week, you know, they couldn't. So I think being at home helps. There's a lot of confidence that comes from the crowd. And in my mind, I think there's a lot of advantages on Lions offense versus their defense. And I think that Seattle will have a few advantages on offense, but it's not as significant as the other way around.
All right. The offensive line for the Seahawks, left to right, rookie Charles Cross, Damian Lewis, Austin Blythe in the pivot, Gabe Jackson at right guard, and other rookie Abraham Lucas at right tackle. Now, these rookie tackles, they're going to really want the challenge of facing fellow rookie Aiden Hutchinson.
Yeah.
Lucas, Cross especially.
I think Cross is going to end up with Charles Harris quite a bit, though.
Yeah, but they flip back and forth.
They do. I think Lucas is going to have a harder time with Aiden. And that's going to be where they probably keep a tight end in when they need to. that's typically what, like, the Vikings were doing a lot of doubles on Aiden on the right side. And I expect Seattle to kind of follow that blueprint to try and take him out of it. An adjustment that I would look towards making is bringing on another pass rusher and then trying to get Aiden inside, because you can get him inside on like Gabe Jackson. That's a massive advantage for Aiden Hutchinson. Whereas if like Michael Brockers or Isaiah Bugs are going against Jackson, I still think it's advantage Lions, but not as significant. Aleem there's potential for Aleem to have one of his best games, because I think he's much better than any of these interior guys. And I think it's a good game, good potential game for Aleem. And it'd be nice to see Charles Harris do something. Charles Cross is not going to be an easy guy. He went like, you know, what do you go, like fifth overall or something like that, whatever this was, right? And so...
Oh, we have this whole internet. We can find out. ninth. So, he went ninth. We were way off. Top 10.
But yeah, so there's still... He's still a rookie, though. And so there should be opportunities for Harris to get some advantage over the rookie, even though, like I said, Charles Cross is a good player.
So Lions struggled last week to rush the passer.
Yeah.
One sack, and that was by Anzalone. That was a nice sack. Mm-hmm. Mirroring week one against the Eagles, whereas they feasted a little bit against Carson Wentz in week two, especially Hutchinson. But so is it going to be more of a game like week two against the Commanders as far as being able to get after the quarterback? Because, you know, two games with only one sack in each game, not good.
Yeah, the pressures are still there. I haven't checked, but I'm sure they're still near the top, if not still like they were leading the league in pressures after two games. I don't know if they're still leading, but I know they're still up. They're going to be up at the top there because they still had a fair amount of pressures in this game as well. I think like 18 or something like that, which is, you know, still up there.
It's not disruptive enough.
That's the thing, right? It does need to be more disruptive. Glenn will of course use the blitz, and that's how you're going to, that's not like how Anzalone got home. Right. But again, that blitz needs to be able to get home as well. So if I'm attacking this offensive line, I'm trying to attack it up the middle. I think that's where it's the most vulnerable. And I'm trying to, maybe they stunt and they stunt Aiden inside, right? Or, you know, there's a variety of ways that you can try and get, you know, pass rush up the middle by using your base front. But if they want to get like into sub package stuff, again, I think you can line Aiden up inside. I think you can, second week in a row, I'm going to say, I think Demetrius Taylor is a guy who could potentially be an interior disruptive player. This is really where you miss Kaminsky. And I don't think Austin Bryant's going to get you that pressure inside, and that's really where you need it. So I'd be interested to see if they could get Demetrius Taylor on the field this week, because I think he's a guy who could be disruptive. And he may play 10 snaps, but he also might get two pressures on those 10 snaps. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'd be willing to test it. Benito is fine, but he's a backup nose tackle. Isaiah Bugs is your starting nose. He should probably be your backup. Aleem is ahead of Brockers at this point, and really Aleem's on that interior by himself. So change something up, get him a little help, and see if you can be more disruptive in the middle.
All right. That's it for the Lion offense versus the Seahawk defense. When it gets to the kicking game, got Jason Myers. He's the kicker. He's, you know, he's fine. 4 for 4 on the season. Yeah. Hasn't missed a kick, made of all of his extra points. You know, traditionally, he's your run-of-the-mill NFL kicker. Makes 85% of his field goals and just about all of his extra points.
Yep. Nothing to write home about.
Michael Dixon's the punter from New South Wales down under. He is a former Ray Guy Award winner. He's a very good punter.
He's been okay this year.
Okay. Yeah, nothing to write home about. DJ Dallas returning kicks. I don't have who's been returning punts for them.
I don't recall either, to be honest. I'm trying to remember. It might
yes,
even,
there's
might
nothing
have been
to worry
DJ.
About. What about the Seattle special teams?
Well, I'll tell you who. I think they have listed as their punt returner, Eskridge, the rookie out of Western, or Western.
Yeah.
He's another guy that was drafted ahead of Amon-Ra St. Brown. If I'm not mistaken, he's at least listed as their.
Yeah, that's what I've listed. I went to look up, see what he's done. It doesn't have anything. Oh,
not
yeah, Amon-Ra cannot like this guy. He's a second round pick, 56. He has on the season, two receptions for 6 yards. So Amon-Ra is going to be watching him at warmups. He's going to be watching what he's doing throughout the game. And that's a shame.
He's a good player too. He just doesn't, he has not been able to
get on the field yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame.
Carson Tinker's the long snapper. I don't think that's important. I guess, Eric, we need to talk about who you think's winning this game. Let's see. We got all the, we took a look at all the positions.
Mm-hmm.
What are your keys for the Lions to win this game? Although I guess I get to pick first because I happened to, sadly, I won again last week.
You did. Yeah, so you do get to go first. I'm still kind of toying with what I think is going to happen. But I'm starting to feel pretty good about, I'm getting closer to what I like. So, yeah, look, I think I kind of highlighted my big keys, right? Like, I think the Lions are going to want to get Jamal Williams running downhill. They're going to want to try and establish the run. If they do, that's going to help open stuff up over the middle for TJ Hockenson. It's going to help open up stuff a little bit deeper if you want to start taking shots at Chark. When you are on defense, you want to see the Lions try and take away Geno's security blankets, which are his tight ends and his running backs. If you can kind of take those guys away, force him to try and go downfield a little bit more, it's a little bit harder for him. I would play in my opinion, I would run like a cover one robber where you're going to just kind of like be able to shift one of your safeties over the top. Plus that robber is going to help you against those kind of security blanket weapons. And then, like I said, I want to see interior pressure. Yeah. I think that's a big key. And so I'd like to see them find a way to dial up some pressure up the middle.
All right. This is a game when we, before the season, we're like, this is a Lions win. This has got to be a Lions win. This looks like a Lions win.
Yep.
The whole team's injured now, and including the two guys who stir the drink on offense,
mm-hmm.
Swift and St. Brown. If neither of those guys play, now St. Brown might play, right? But if neither of those guys play, you're going to say, well, they still have Jamal Williams. They still have TJ Hockenson. It's not the same as those two guys. They're the two reasons why this offense is so improved, is their continued growth in the system. Mm-hmm. Defensively, we've already seen what the loss of Tracy Walker means to the defense. But that being said, they've had a whole week to work with the younger guys, and maybe that's not as noticeable against the Seahawks. And luckily, they are playing the Seahawks, who don't have the greatest offense on the planet. They have to be able to tackle. As you said, they're going to be doing a lot of short stuff. So the Lions need to, you know, put a stop to everything that's happening right away. Man, if they don't, I'm being conservative because of the injuries. I'm really concerned because of these injuries. And I'm going to say the Seahawks are going to win 24-21.
Oh my goodness.
It's all because this was going to be a win. This was going to be the first time I was going to pick them to win if St. Brown and Swift were playing. But if they're not, they're going to have a hard time winning this game.
I don't see it that way. I think they can win it with the guys that they have, even if those two guys are out. I'm calling 31-24. I think if you can watch, if Atlanta can put up 27, I think the Lions can put up more. 31 is me actually thinking, okay, they're going to be pretty consistent scoring throughout the game. Whereas I kind of got that feeling you're going to see Seattle maybe score 17 points in the first half. And then I eventually they're going to be able to score in the second half, right? Beyond right. those 10 points.
They're an NFL team.
I think they can get another seven, but I'm not going to give them much more than that. So I'm going to have the Lions cover the original spread and win 31-24.
Yeah. I hope you're right. What I say it every week. I hope you're right. And if they do, there'd be 2-2 and things won't be that bad. You know, that Minnesota loss will start looking a little bit more in the rearview mirror.
If they had Swift, I would have given them another 5 points. And if they would have for sure had St. Brown, I would have given them another 5 points. You know what I mean? Wow. Honestly,
the 41, like, 41 points.
I would have gone up to like 40 points. Oh, yep. Boy. 40.
No wonder why I win all the time. that's a lot to ask for on any
but team. But this I know, but like, listen, the Seahawks defense, I am not impressed by them, and yes, it's a bend don't break, but they are allowing teams to run or to achieve almost 50 yards every single drive. Like every single drive they're going for 50. They're allowing 2.6 points a drive, right? And so you get 8-9 drives and all of a sudden you're like, hey, you know, that's, you know, I don't know. You do the math. I know you can do it fast. They're allowing 8.8 passing yards per attempt. That's last in the league. 8.8 yards every time they want to pass. Not
completions. Just
no attempt. Yep. Attempt. Yep. Right. Like, so I don't know how you stop people when you're giving up that much yardage at that clip. Like, it just, they're the 31st worst passing defense. They're the 21 worst run defense.
So they're all good signs, Eric.
But, and I think their run defense is pretty bad, to be honest. 21, I was surprised about. I thought that would have been lower as well. I'm, this is a rebuilding defense that has some pieces that might be good, but they are not very scary at all for me.
All right. Well, looking at the rankings, we really haven't had a budge in the ratings over the last week. But, hey, we still appreciate everybody who's done so, everybody who will do so in the future, and everybody that is currently listening. And do you have anything to add about this game? I hope you're right, Eric. I hope your optimism is dead on this week.
I think, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm kind of just going to keep beating the same principles down here and just
run the ball.
I think
to set Jamal, up the play action.
Jamal's 80 yards was a career high. I think he breaks that. You know what I mean? And then we'll see what Goff can do when he starts cutting the ball loose a little bit as well. So, everything seems to be everything seems to be favoring the Lions, especially that offense and defense combination.
We'll let it go on that high note. That's all we got for this week. So until next time, let's go Lions.